Thank you. So I'm going to start off and kind of get into the whole global agronomy thing with the basic introduction of my talk is going to be globally in the Midwest. So as you see, the title involves some of the things that we've talked about here today. Cover crops, corn grain, I don't call it maize, I call it corn, and terrain, which we see from a lot of the studies that we have. This work was pioneered by myself, Dr. Sasha Kravchenko, and Dr. Siglinda Snatt at Michigan State, and we use data from Dr. Eileen Kladivko at Purdue and Dr. Peter Scharf at Missouri. Basic outline, introduction, then we'll go over the objective hypothesis that I had, the experimental design and methodology I used for two studies that I'm going to present results on, and then I'll conclude at the end, and then we can go into some discussion. Basic introduction, why do we talk about diverse terrain? Well, we could see from some of those previous slides of some photos in Africa, not every single field plot we deal with is this perfect, flat, uniform area that we can do research on or that farmers can actually use. So this picture right here is a little slide of shows slope percentage, and this is the one of the sites that we use at our Michigan State location in Mason, and we blocked our experimental units actually by topography, so they kind of fit in this funny little angle, and people drive by and say that they don't really look regular, but we wanted to catch things like depression areas, like slope areas, and like these summit areas. So I'll stick with those three topographical features. Like I said, those features matter because we were able to see some huge differences based on those topographies. And not all the field sites that we use are the same. Topography is something that we can't replicate perfectly in a randomized complete block design, so we use classifications in order to justify those things that I'm calling slope, summits, and depressions. The next part, we use cereal rye. And why cereal rye? It's a great cover crop for northern latitudes, and Michigan being one of those areas where we wanted to implement cover crop usage. So we planted it after 2 year rotations, corn and soybeans. Benefits to it, it's great at erosion control. If it gets early enough in the spring, we can use it as a nutrient scavenger. And it can be excellent as a weed suppressor too. So there's a lot of great benefits to rye, but some of the problems with it and the cons, allelopathic effects, sometimes it can enhance nitrogen immobilization, and that can be a detriment to the corn crop. It also can compete for water, especially in drier winters that we had in 2012. When we went to go plant our corn cover crop or our corn in the spring, we noticed that the plots didn't have as much water as they should. So the objective was to demonstrate these differences that we saw on our corn plots with cover crops versus our corn plots without cover crops that I'll call fallow, at each different topographical position, because it wasn't the same across sites. So the first hypothesis, I wanted to look at, I said that the rye cover crop would vary based on the different topographic positions that we had. And the second hypothesis, more of a long-term one, is that we would actually see increases in yields at these different topographic positions from the origin of the system. So all these sites didn't have cover crops, and we introduced that in 2011. So I'm looking at 4 years of data, and this project, actually I have the fifth year that I haven't put together yet. What led to this was a paper by Miguez and Bolero in 2005. So it really looked at a meta-analysis of all of these types of research using cover crops in their corn yields, and they found that in biculture systems, so this graph on the right, taken from Crop Science, it has the logarithmic scale of corn yield advantage. In the middle would be no advantage, so there's basically they came out to zero. On the left side, negative, and on the right side, positive. In the biculture, more generally than not, we saw an increase. In our grasses, where we have rye that we use in this study, more often than not, we saw a negative yield decrease. And in the legumes, we actually saw that yield increase. Now, this didn't go as far as to say, was it 2 year rotations, was it 3 year rotations, and most of the stuff was on flat ground, not looking at topography. So we added the element of diverse terrain, call it something different. Getting an experimental design, we used two sites from Michigan. one at Purdue and one in Missouri. This was part of the CSCAT project that started in 2011. So taking a whole plethora of sites and using different methods, or actually the same methods, to look at different things. So not all in the same in nitrogen, drainage. We were just looking at cover crops, and we select these four sites, because of their topography. Here are the four sites. At Michigan, we had digital elevation models that we made. At CPAC, at Purdue, they had one. They did not have one at the Bradford site, so that's why I had to use an aerial photograph. But at these three sites, topography was built in as a main factor of the experimental design. For the CPAC site, we had to build that with classifying the topography in the DEM and then selecting these specific plots based on yield monitor data. And then I averaged the yield monitor data to come up with a value that would be most similar to what we had at the other three sites. CPAC and Bradford, more on the lower latitudes, silt loams with no tillage, Mason and Kellogg, two tillage systems, chisel plow and ridge tillage, and both are very light soils, sandy loam, fine sandy loam, gravel, more at the Mason site. Getting into the methodology, so for the graphs I'm going to show, the values are literally what the corn yield was from the plot with rye, subtracted by the corn yield with the plot was fallow. So when I have a positive value, that meant that the rye plot yielded more. When I had negative value, the fallow yielded more. The second part of the study was when we saw that we had these differences, we tried to investigate further, and we did this at our Mason and Kellogg site. We went through and we actually paid an undergrad to go through and count plants for 2 weeks at every site, at every plot, which can be very painstaking, to go through, and we used those repeated measures designed to see if emergence was affected. So did these plants come up at different times that we could go for and there discern some sort of results when we look at the yield graphs. Getting into the CPAC data. Introduction of cover crop in the fall of 2011 was killed in the spring of 2012, and then our corn was planted. So the graphs go left to right, summit slope depression, and then the year on the x-axis. So where we had depression plots in two of the years, we saw those negative effects on yield. In 2013, it was a great yield, we had good cover crop growth, and we saw positive gains from those cover crops on the whole thing. Going to the Bradford site at Missouri, this is something that really piqued our interest because we saw negative cover crop growth or cover crops on the yield in both 2012 and 2013. And then in 2014 and 2015, we're able to see those values become closer to zero. So we're expecting that the cover crop had some sort of positive effect and was leading to these yield gains that we see here. Now all these values are in kilograms per hectare, and we know that 87 kilograms per hectare is pretty minuscule. But at least we're not seeing the large negative effects of almost, 1,000, 1,100 kilograms. At the Mason site, very variable, was very difficult to quantify because we had some big problems with our depression plots in 2013 and having excess moisture. So we had a loss of yield from environment factor, we essentially had to call it. But yet we see the same trend from the other sites that our depression plots were the ones that were most hurt by this. And then in our summits and slopes, we saw general increases except for this past year. The Kellogg site, also at Michigan State, again, a sandy soil, more lighter soil. 2012, 2013, we see that trend where we had big negative effects. In 2014 and 2015, we're able to mitigate those, and we're hoping that the cover crop was having some sort of positive effect on it. So years after introduction. Combining all sites into a four-year ANOVA, very, very messy, a lot of variability in this, but at the last year, so my second hypothesis showing that we're able to improve those yields on those summits and those depression areas, the slopes did not cooperate in even one of these years. The last two slides of results I'll show are they're pretty boring unless you really, really like ANOVA tables, and my advisor loves them, so I threw them in there. But the first set of results I'll show will be from our Mason site. So remember, I had that undergrad go back for every 2 days for 2 weeks, then he counted plants. And so the first from the summit, we only saw a significant difference in the emergence of corn was delayed from the plots that had cover crops at that first day. And we called significance at 0.1, just so we could try to find something. But we didn't have anything at that Mason site, so that doesn't describe those differences. At the Kellogg site, where that graph looked great, where we saw the 2012 and 2013 data was pretty negative, and then we got better the next 2 years, we did see differences about 11 to 2 weeks after planting. So at each position, 2 weeks after planting, the corn emergence were reduced significantly by the presence of a cover crop. In the actual population data, the harvest population that we take at the end, there were no significant differences. They were around 70 to 74,000 plants per hectare. So in conclusion, we had large differences that varied by topography at each location at each year. It's really difficult task to try to hammer out exactly why we saw these, and we have temperature data and moisture data from the Michigan sites that were part of another grant that we're able to have 4 years of data from that. So my next step is to go through and actually try to see if temperature and soil moisture were affected by the cover crops, and could that possibly explain some of these variations that we had. What we saw too is the depressions are the greatest concern. So if I were to come up and a farmer were to say, you know, I really want to plant rye after my corn or rye after my soybean, put it in, you know, I would say, do you have any areas that are low, that are constantly wet? And I would stay away from those areas, because that's where we saw the biggest negative effects on our corn yield. But then we can also think about how cover crops can benefit in ways other than yield. This study purely looked to quantify those differences. But we didn't look in, and especially with what we have in topography, on those slopes, we have almost 20, 22% grade. There's high probability of erosion in those spots. So there are some ways that we could use ecosystem services to quantify how cover crops could be benefit in ways other than yield. And in my second hypothesis, I wanted to look at a four-year period. Well, anybody who's been working in cover crops knows that it takes longer amounts of time in order to try to discern differences in helping organic matter and some of these soil carbon pools. So I'd like to thank the CAP project, Michigan State, Purdue, and Missouri for allowing me to use their yield. And I'll take any questions. Mr. David.
How long did the cover crop do?
The cover crop at, so how well did the cover crop do? At the Missouri and the Purdue sites, we were able to get over 2,000 kilograms per hectare. But at the Michigan sites, we're less than 1,000. More so, but the cover crop grew more so into those depression plots, because when it really took off and grew was in the spring, and those areas had more moisture left over from the winter. And so we're wondering if maybe the larger amount of cover crop had something to do with those negative yields. Yes. They were killed with glyphosate about 10 to 14 days before planting, and then with the Mason and to the two Michigan State sites, then we chisel plowed. But at the other two sites, it was no-till, so there was just glyphosate that way.
To answer part of my question, how and when, did you take soil-borne diseases into account at all, causing damping off of some of your corn into effect?
We did.
In those low-lying areas,
right.
Where it might be wetter.
Right, especially at the Michigan State site. I've been to all four sites, and I can speak with extreme clarity that the Michigan State site, where there was ponding effects, there definitely had to be some sort of negative effect because of just the excess soil moisture was there. In the CPAC site, for example, Eileen didn't want me to use that data because it's technically what she called a washout. And what I told her is that the actual DEM showed that this is a depression that reflects what we're seeing at the other three sites. We had to use it. So what, you know, and Eileen's a big extension person. She would just tell somebody that data is no good to begin with. Any other questions?
Yeah, I think we better start.
Okay.
Thank you, Richard.
Right. Yep.
Very good.